Hey y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and More. Today, I have a very special guest and friend that I cannot wait to talk with her to you. But if we think about it, from Beverly Hills reality TV to Instagram feeds everywhere, Kris Jenner has made plastic surgery a kitchen table conversation, and she's not the only one changing the game. My guest today is Dr. Dahlia Rice, a board-certified plastic surgeon and the founder of DM Are Aesthetics in Chicago. She brings an incredible depth of training and experience to her work, earning her medical degree at Rush Medical College here in Chicago and completing her general surgery training in Michigan State, as well as going through a very highly competitive integrated plastic surgery residency at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Before that, she built a rock-solid academic foundation in getting a master's in biomedical science with a concentration in neurology and bachelor's of in biology, focused on anatomy, both from Colorado State University. Over the years, she's honed her skills in everything from facelifts and blepharoplasty to breast augmentation, tummy tucks, chin liposuction, and labiaplasty. Dr. Rice is passionate about helping women look and feel their best, whether through subtle refinements or transformative surgeries, always with the safety, artistry, and empowerment at the forefront. Today, we'll talk about celebrity influence, the latest innovations in surgical techniques, the controversies making headlines, and how plastic surgery intersects with aging, sexual health, and self-advocacy. I'm here to educate so you can advocate, so let's get into it. Hey, Dahlia. So
Hi.
Nice of you to join me today. Thank you. I know you're so busy, so thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to have me on the show. I'm super excited.
This is going to be great. Dahlia and I met just about a year ago, right? And we've become friends ever since. So I think it was just like, was it through social media? No,
it was. It was through, through friends and a publicist. Yep. Everybody kept hearing about your name because I was new in town, and everyone's like, "Oh my God, you got to meet Dr. Rahman. She's amazing." And they were 100% right.
In some beautiful purple, like full outfits, and you know, beautiful bag, and you know, just like what
you're very fashionable.
what you'd expect and what you'd want from your plastic surgeon, TBH. So
true. I would,
you know, you don't want to come at a plastic surgeon and see like, oh, they're a little grungy.
Disheveled, exactly. Yes, exactly. And I think art, you know, people who are into artistry-based things, like they love fashion too. It's another form of expression and creativity. And I think, especially as women, like that's something that we very much, you know, use to express ourselves.
Yeah. Well, let's just start there. What drew you into plastics and like what keeps you passionate about it?
Good question. So actually, this is my second career. I first started doing autopsies before I came to medical school.
Oh,
I was in Colorado at the time, and I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I loved anatomy, and so I was a pathologist assistant, and I was doing autopsies.
That's
and after a couple of years, the forensic pathologist I worked with was like, Dahlia, it's time for you to go to med school. Like, really? So I said, okay.
Oh, I'm just thinking like FDU in my background, like the criminal.
My family is like not educated. So I never really got that like guidance for med school. And so I applied. And once I got in, I thought that I wanted to do forensic pathology. And really, it was the anatomy that I loved, the variety. And so when I started to get exposed to plastic surgery in medical school, it's kind of hard because it's not a normal rotation you go on. You don't do an, I decided to do an externship. I had to try to find people along the way. And I basically was able to kind of explore it that way. And really when I kind of opened my eyes to it, because I think like society likes to think that's all we do is boobs and butts. But when I started looking at all the reconstructive stuff, we did facial reanimation, which was insane. We worked on babies. We worked on older patients, men, women, and really a lot of the surgeries were pretty positive. Like patients would come in, they were very excited, very happy about the changes that were going to happen. And so that really kind of made me realize that that's kind of the vibe I want to bring in. You know, I love to bring people, make people happy. And so for me, you know, having patients that are excited to see me, excited about changes that make them feel good, that's really what really kind of drove me into that field. I love working with women. And so in plastics, we do a lot of that, obviously. And so did a lot of breast reconstruction for some years. And now I've transferred, I opened up my own practice about a year and a half ago doing primarily cosmetic-based surgery. But I do a lot of transgender surgeries as well and other things that really kind of help fulfill my, you know, palette of the variety that I really enjoy.
I mean, is that how you kind of define success? Because like, I feel like plastic surgeons, you guys are like perfectionists, you know, you're always like the details. I mean, just like even working with you, I just see how much detail you put into everything and you're so meticulous. I mean, I've sent a number of my own patients to you and they come back and I'm like, damn, you look good. What happened to you? And you're like,
Thank you. And that's the thing. I think it's important to know the details matter, you know, and honoring someone's own anatomy. I'm not trying to change that person's looks. I'm trying to obviously listen to what they're telling me that they don't like and then giving them realistic options about what they can and cannot do. And also just in general, like, you know, trying to figure out, you know, is this really what they're asking? And really kind of getting those little fine tuning of things makes all the difference because that really can set apart a good result from a great result.
I mean, I think you and I are both in a field that gets dismissed and or thought of as a luxury, right? Like good sex life is thought of as a luxury. Sexual pain is discounted. You know, people that have like persistent genital arousal disorders, these things that are really just debilitating for patients are discounted. Insurances don't want to cover it because it's not a real thing. It's something that maybe you should get psych for instead, you know, and same, you know, even with all of like menopause and transformations and midlife and all these things, it's so much about like what is considered like an almost ancillary where for so many people, it's life transformative. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Or even the shaming, right? In your field, my field, there's a lot of shaming. The family's like, why are you doing this? You know, you don't need to do that. You're beautiful the way you are. Or you know, providers will gaslight people, right? You know, they're coming in with pain and real problems, sexual health issues. And they're kind of taught like that they shouldn't really say anything because they are made to feel like they're crazy or that they're wrong for wanting these things. And I think that you know, very much speaks a lot to us as women in society, because that is pretty much the crux of how we've been raised in society is to be small, to be happy, to sort of like look your best, but we don't want you to do surgery, plastic surgery, because that's taboo. You just need to naturally be beautiful. And then
it's not a whole, it's impossible to be a woman Barbie speech, right? Like it really is.
Right, exactly. It's 100%. But I think, you know, aesthetics and what people enjoy and what people find bothersome about themselves is so unique and different and personal. And some people will come in and say, Dr. Rice, what do you think? Like, what do you think? Tell me what I need to have done. And I always say, like, I don't like to answer that question because it's not my job to tell you what I think is, you know, a flaw. It is your job to tell me what you don't and you know, like about your features. What are the things that you used to like? What are the things that you want to develop more? Yeah. And so I really make people kind of focus on that. And because a lot of times I'll also be like, well, this, and this. And I'm like, nope, pick one, this, two, that, three. And so really getting people to hone in on the very specific things that are bothering them. And that, I think, especially as we're in our 40s, and we start to hit that phase of where there's that rapid aging phase where you wake up one day and you're like, I don't even recognize this face anymore. Yep. And at that point, people start to freak out and they just don't really know what to do or where to start even because there's so much fear mongering out there as well.
I mean, not to mention the fact that like we're not allowed to age, right? Like,
exactly.
You gain weight, you lose your sexual desire. Like, you know, it's like, what the hell how are we supposed to even function sometimes? And so
it's so true.
It's just, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about aging in a second, but you're mentioning like just the whole idea of, you know, what we're allowed to, like, we accept women's suffering much more in this society, almost like a norm, like it's acceptable for women to suffer.
Yep.
I mean, think about, you say you do a lot of breast recon. Think about, you know, the pink elephant in the room, as my friend Corinne Men says, the patients who have had breast cancer who are now survivors. Or years out, they don't get, you know, the therapies they need. They don't get the sexual education or attention they need. But tell me a little bit about the breast stuff, right? Because I feel like so many of them are like, well, you know, your breasts are, you know, that's body image is huge, right? For sexual function.
Huge.
How you feel about yourself and your day-to-day, like, ability to cope even sometimes.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the first things we do is put a bra on, right? So it's very much ingrained in our lives as women.
And so how do you go through kind of talking through a patient who's maybe, I mean, because we could talk about if you want, like all the new things, because like I think people used to use expanders or maybe they still do. And now they can straight into mastectomy plus, right? But maybe you can give us a little, you know, history around that if you want. But like, I think that's such a huge factor, right? Because a lot of women feel like, you know, is nipple sparing better? Is it not? Like, where are all this, the data and the feelings around, you know, how patients experience it? What have you seen in your practice? And what do you think the most important things to consider for people that are breast cancer survivors listening and maybe wondering?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because I think a lot of breast cancer survivors and breast cancer patients are very much in a similar boat to all the other things that we experience as women. They're taught, you know, they come in, well, I don't like this. Well, you should be happy with what you have.
You should
see, you have good reconstruction. Yep. You should, I saved your life. You should be happy. You should see a bad reconstruction. And it's literally little stuff like dog ears or a little bit of some asymmetry, like stuff that's totally fixable that can really make the person accept their reconstruction as their own body. I call it their survivor body. Right. And so then you have to learn to relove a new form of yourself, because it's not the old person anymore, right? This is a new body that has survived cancer. And that's a really beautiful thing. And that will continue to age and change over time. What we're finding is that a lot of these, especially insurance companies, are giving a lot of pushback for revision stuff or making things more symmetric or doing things to help kind of improve the overall aesthetic and feel of these breast reconstruction patients. And I think that there has been so much more technical-based things that have advanced in these areas of the last 5-10 years to be able to offer more nipple-sparing mastectomies, to be able to offer really well-done flaps that are, you know, borrowed from your own body, some tissue to use and make a breast out of. And it's even from those patients, I hear people say like, well, I feel guilty doing this for myself. And it's like, girl, you just had breast cancer. Like, you went through all the things. Yeah. Like, you shouldn't feel guilty for this. Like, but they view it as like, oh, well, it makes me vain. And I'm like, no, this does not. It makes you whole as a person. Yeah. And you have to be able to, you know, look at yourself in the mirror and say like, yeah, hell yeah, I made it through cancer. This is my uniform, my warrior body. This is the one that took me through that.
Yeah.
And it's not the same. But even when we change in life, our bodies are not the same.
Right.
You know, you go through menopause, it's not the same.
Right.
You're going through babies, it's not the same. Each time you have a baby, it changes. Weight gain, weight loss. Yeah. And so we're constantly scrutinized as women over our bodies.
Yeah.
And I think this is just a great example, again, of how all the different varieties are out there of breast reconstruction. Some people don't offer every single one of them. So a lot of times patients don't even know the options fully. And then additionally, they're often kind of told like, once they're done, you're good to go. You don't really need anything else, like except for some maintenance stuff. But to me, that was something that I really felt that people left those patients in the dark about. You know, they just kind of had to accept the pains, because they had a lot of scar tissue pain too, and capsular contractures, other issues that come with other surgeries. It, a lot of times they would just sort of essentially be told like, this is good enough and you should be happy with where you're at, even though they're wearing like a bra that is not the same cup. You know, the cup sizes are completely different.
Yeah.
I had one patient cut a bra and sew two different bras together to make her breast fit.
Oh, wow.
Like, the fact that she went to those lengths tells us how much
we're not,
you know, that, you know, breast reconstruction is just not really something that people are allowed to take seriously sometimes. And that's really unfortunate, considering, you know, on the flip side, how much, how the lengths that we go through for men having reconstruction.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was in my training, we were talking about vaginal reconstruction for a woman that had a cancer, a rectal cancer that invaded into her vaginal wall.
Yeah.
And we were doing reconstruction on her and we were talking about vaginal reconstruction. And I clearly remember one of my attendings say, she doesn't need that. It's just a vagina, basically. Like, let's like show it up, sew it up and call it a day. And I'm thinking, what?
I know.
What? Yeah. Like, that's how they think, right? And so it's just like the concept. We have to change the mindset of what it is to be a woman, why it's not okay for us to suffer in silence, and how to advocate for ourselves in a way that people hear us and or find doctors that will listen to you, which is
so
one of the reasons why I absolutely adore you.
No, and you know, it's interesting because when I remember doing my urogynecology rotation, and we would do this procedure called a colpoplysis, which was like for older women who had like severe prolapse, and you basically sealed up their vagina, right? So, and it's like, okay, yeah, maybe they are like, but you know, this day and age, we should be able and allowed to have patients have great sex throughout their life. I mean, I have 70-year-olds, 80-year-olds coming in, new boyfriends, you know, somebody passed away in their life, you know, new girlfriend, whatever it is, right? And they're like, just fix my vagina. And I'm like, let's go, you know?
Yeah, let's do this exactly. Let's get that girl running. Because I think that's the thing, too, is that when you feel confident in your body and you feel confident knowing that you can still enjoy your life and still enjoy your sexual health, you know, that looks different for everybody, right? Some people want to look good naked. Other people want to look good with their clothes on. Yeah. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that everybody wants, you know, to take care of themselves, right? Right. And if we view it as self-care and maintenance, then it's not as much stigmatized. And so I get a lot of men who will ask me about skincare and be like, oh, well, that's for women and that's, you know, this and that. And I'm like, no one is going to look at you and say taking care of your skin is a terrible thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's all maintenance. And if you change the wording, so I change the wording a lot to maintenance because like Botox, fillers, skincare stuff, like it's all maintenance to maintain your own natural beauty, your own natural look that you want to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's so interesting because I think that, you know, you're right. There's just so much shame around wanting to do it even. Like I oftentimes patients won't even tell me they've had like a breast aug and I'm doing their breast exam. I'm like, oh, it feels like you have some saline or, you know, I totally forgot to tell you, doctor, but I did this when I was 18. I'm so regretful.
Yeah. Well, I have people who try to hide it from their entire families. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm going to pretend I'm going to work today and I'm going to go get surgery and then I'm going to come back. It's like, and people even going through breast cancer reconstruction and surgeries, they didn't want to tell their family. They felt like they were a burden to the family if they brought up that they wanted to do these things. And so it's super interesting to hear people tell me that because, you know, I'm like, well, this is your body. You get to make those decisions. And you shouldn't feel guilty for wanting the things that you want. There's nothing, you know, there's no shame in that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that's helped is obviously like, I mean, social media has been pretty outstanding, I think, for a lot of plastics surgeons because the before and afters are so compelling, right? Like, I feel like when people post before and afters, and then also just like celebrity and like pop culture in general has really opened up the conversations. Like I have had so many friends tell me like, it's kind of like that, you know, back in the day when you had, when Harry met Sally and she's like the orgasm thing where I'll have what she's having. Some friends are like, I'll have what Kris Jenner's having because she looks good.
Right.
So
she looks good and she looks very natural. Very natural. We have changed things so significantly over the last 10, 15 years in plastic surgery world, focusing more on natural aesthetics, natural anatomical boundaries, really honoring that. Yeah. And then also like an undetectable era of plastic surgery where people can have plastic surgery and you may or may not even know it. Yeah. Whereas people are scared of those things because they are scared to look like, you know, crazy people.
Right.
And so, you know, I spend a lot of time reassuring patients. Exactly.
Right. You see the bot, I mean, there was a whole show on it, right? Like bot.
Yes.
Or whatever. But like, you know, you get scared about some of those things because people do look so different or they look so like not good really. You know, they look kind of like, you know, too fake, too whatever. And so, but everyone like agrees that she just looks like she turned the clock back. Right. Like,
which has been interesting because I have a lot of people who reach out to me and be like, what do you think they had done? What do you think this person had done?
And tell us.
And that's just what do I think, Christian? So I think the thing that's super interesting about her facelift in general and why people are making waves about it is, you know, there was a lot of talk. Oh, did she have a deep plane facelift? Did she have her, you know, a mass, you know, a traditional facelift? Because there's many different varieties of facelifts. Yeah. And the surgeon that she chose, you know, doesn't really do a lot of deep plane facelifts. So there is a theory that she probably had a regular facelift, you know, where we do what we call a smastectomy, where we kind of pull that area up instead of going into the deep plane of the face. So that might be part of the reason why. But also, if you look at all the other things, you look at her skin, you look at her lips, you look at how before she had, you know, these like deep lines around her lips, like smoker's lines. Yeah. And so what we don't know or what we didn't get the hint of is that she's clearly had a lot of adjunct procedures with this, right? And this is the time in plastic surgery where we're starting to see the rise of these little subtle things that we're doing that are really changing the game.
Yeah.
It takes a good facelift to a great facelift. Yeah. And those are typically fat transfer at the same time or fat transfer around the same time. So doing fat transfer to replace volume because the facelift will help the face, lower face and the neck. But when we're looking at volume loss in general, you know, around the eye area, especially, like we lose a lot of volume up in here. We lose a lot of volume around the eyes. And so really kind of focusing on everything. I think that Kris Jenner also probably had a lip lift with hers. But then also a lot of these adjunct things, laser treatments, skin treatments, you know, really great skincare. Yeah. But I think a lot of what we're seeing is these added on things that aren't necessarily something you point your finger at and say, oh, she did this or she did that.
Yeah.
But it creates this general softness, naturalness to the final result. And it creates a more harmonious look. Yeah.
Quick reality check. If you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for it. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called. It wants its power back. Let's go.
Yeah, which is what most patients want.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that's true. I think that, do you think that like when these celebrities come out and admit, like, you know, you have all these people that like there's theories about whether or not they took Ozempic or GLP-1, you know, and so, but they're not coming forth and saying it because of, you know, stigmas or whatever. But when they do have to admit that they've had these procedures publicly, do you think it creates like more pressure for women, or do you feel like it empowered? I guess it could probably be both, but what do you think?
I think it's double-edged sword because a lot of people are like, well, she looked better before. Like you always have the group of people that are like, yeah, well, this person looked better before. And so maybe, but also like, it doesn't really matter what I think or you think as long as they're happy.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's ultimately at the end of the day, the person that matters the most is the person who had the surgery. Right. And so I think it does empower women somewhat to be like, you know what? Maybe I do want to do something. But then they hear about these price tags of these of some of these things, because facelifts can run $150,000 to $300,000, right? Yeah. And so people see that and they're like, whoa,
right?
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Or they get nervous and anxious again about the whole process of everything and looking fake. And so I think there is a component where we are allowing people now, like as women, we feel more confident and comfortable having procedures, having plastic surgery, talking about it. And really, I think a lot of this, the millennial generation pushed for that.
Yeah.
We weren't going to go down quiet.
Yeah.
We weren't going to go down like our parents did. Yeah. Like, you know, if you have menopause, go out to the pasture and die, right? Yeah. It was not happening.
Yeah, no.
We are not going down like that.
Yeah.
And so from our standpoint, we really pushed for a lot of changes in the aesthetic industry that give us a more natural aesthetic and also allows us to not necessarily have big surgeries. Like we don't want big results like they used to have, like huge transformative results.
Yeah.
We want little things along the way that are going to help preserve our beauty that we're looking for without having to be like, people come out and be like, whoa, this person's totally different looking, right?
Yeah.
You want somebody who's not really going to be able to tell what they had done.
It's
to the point where they're asking, what did you have done?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these adjunct things, that's when we start seeing that. When I do my facelifts and I add fat transfer with that and maybe just an upper eyelid surgery with it, like people stop these patients and are like, what did you have done exactly? Because it looks so natural, but yet they can't quite put their finger on exactly what this person had done. Kind of similar to Kris Jenner, right? She looks great. We can't figure out what it is exactly. But we have some suspicions.
Yeah.
But, you know, these other little things added to it kind of really help create a more cohesive look.
Yeah, no, that's true too. I think that's always the best. Like even the patients I've sent to you and I come back, I'm like, wait, you look different, but like really, like you just look more bright or more like, you know.
Yes. And people get terrified. I don't want someone to see me. I don't want to go out in public. Yeah. And I'm like, I promise you, no one's looking at you like you are. And no one's going to notice these things like you do.
Yeah, that's true. Other celebrities like, you know, that have gotten like, I think negative, like Monica from Friends, Courtney Cox, right? Like she got a lot of negative press around her fillers for a while and
right.
She got them dissolved. Like, let's talk a little bit about the filler industry. I feel like it's changed a lot. Like, people aren't going for fillers as much.
Correct. So I think there was a huge rise. So there was a huge rise in the use of fillers. Mm-hmm. And that's when we started to see everyone kind of having more of a pillow face, being overfilled, mm-hmm. you know, all these things. And I think a lot of that came with the fact that we didn't have a lot of other options mm-hmm. for tools, right? Right. And so whenever I'm talking to people and we're talking about different injectors and stuff, you know, you have to have somebody who has all the tools in their toolbox so that, you know, you're you know, not every person is going to need the same thing.
Right.
And not every person is going to need the same regimen that the other person has. Right. And you really have to look at someone's anatomy and ask, okay, well, what is it specific about their anatomy that they're telling me they don't like? And how do we fix that in a way that has more natural look to it rather than trying to just blow up that area?
Right.
And I think that, again, it comes down with technical skills, right? We have a lot of people in the industry out there that are not as technically advanced as other people, right? And that's okay because it takes time to get there. But, you know, you can't really be very good at it if you don't necessarily understand like how the aging process works and how the anatomy really plays into a huge part of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I was at 2012 or something. I had an interest in some of that. And so I took like, you know, some medical aesthetic courses at the, you know, Academy of Medical Aesthetic, whatever it was in San Diego. And I did it for a very short period of time because I realized like, I'm not going to be good at it unless I do a huge volume of this. And
right,
it wasn't something that I felt like was something I enjoyed. You know, at some point, I was like, I really enjoy doing it. It's very stressful. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's stressful because the patients are very, you know, it's their face. Like, it has to be perfect. You know, you want to make sure symmetry is there. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It is hard. And you have to also be able to hear what the patient's telling you and be able to tell them, like, yes, this is going to work, or no, this is not going to work. Or, you know what? We've gone too far here. We need to fully dissolve this and start all over again. And that's hard for patients to hear, but that's the reality of it is, you know, sometimes what they're looking for is not in conjunction with a very simple in-office procedure of using filler, right? And so I see a lot of these patients that become overfilled. I do a lot of ultrasound-guided filler dissolving. And so that really helps me identify where the pockets of filler are, because over time they can form granulomas, they can be hiding in areas that we didn't expect them to because they can migrate. And in general, they can also infiltrate in through the tissues. And so that can really change a lot of the patient's appearance, making them appear that puffiness. It can clog the lymphatics in the face, causing a lot of puffiness around the eyes. It can also cause issues with lymphatic blockage around the lip area, causing, you know, lots of swelling and abnormal, you know, deformities from hardness from the granulomas, because those can sometimes surface to the skin. I think the things that we're learning, too, is that fillers don't go away like we thought they would. You know, we are always told in the industry, oh, they're within 12 to 16 months, they're gone, 2 years, whatever. I mean, we're seeing a lot of variety of patients. And I think a lot of this speaks to people's own metabolic genetic makeup, right? Because I see some people come in who had fillers, had them in years ago, still have it. I see some people who've had fillers 6 months ago, looks like they've had nothing. And so really how people break down their products makes a big difference. And not only that, but just like technique wise, you know, if you're really looking at somebody's face and they're like, well, I don't like my smile lines. Yeah. Well, the answer isn't necessarily to just fill that one line and call it a day, because then you lose the cohesivity of the face. The more you add to one spot, it looks like another spot's further away. Mm-hmm. And so trying to get that into balance is not so easy sometimes. But also, for the most part, people are pretty open to understanding the idea of facial balancing and how important that is overall. I like to tell people in general that you can expect like multiple different avenues, but there's about three main arms. There's going to be like the skincare regimen stuff, which is tone, texture of the skin, and that should not be discounted by any means, because that really is the canvas that you're working with. Then the fillers and Botox are going to be volume replacement, neuromodulation for wrinkles. And then last category, obviously, is surgery. And people are always like, oh my God, surgery. But I'm going to talk about a couple of little procedures that can be done that can be super powerful, that don't necessarily put you down really heavy, but can really make a big, big difference for you overall. Like, people, as we start to get towards this late 30s and on, like, when do you do what, you know? And that's always the question that I get asked. Well, when am I supposed to start doing this? When am I supposed to start doing that? Yeah. And I tell people right away, Trenton Owen, 100% right away, immediately.
Absolutely. And then what else? Like, what are the little procedures that you think make a difference, you know, with each decade of life in terms of that? I mean, Botox, right?
Botox, for sure. I think a lot of this is, you know, comfort level too. Someone can come in, they've never been exposed to any of it before. So starting them off slowly, I think is super important so that you can build upon it so that they don't forget what they look like. They don't get that, like, you know, kind of body dysmorphia where there's like small changes over time and then you change how you view yourself over time or what you think you can obtain. And so that drift that can happen is real. And I think that there's a lot of value to doing things in segments because then people can really also give a lot of feedback. Yes, I like this. No, I didn't. And so sometimes starting people off with Botox, skincare regimen, and a little bit of filler can make a bit, can really go a long way. And again, we used to do larger volumes of filler years ago, just like tons of it. And that's how we got overfilled, right? And then we kind of backed off. We're like, okay, you don't need that much. Maybe a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, and like learning how to break that up. And so whenever I'm talking to my patients and I'm talking to them about they've never had anything done, what can I do? Usually these are people who are either, or they've had Botox one or two other times, and they said, well, I really didn't like it because it made my eyelids feel super heavy, you know, and they're in their early 40s or something like that. I tell people, look, yes, Botox is going to feel heavy because now you have laxity in your upper eyelids. And if you had hooded eyes to begin with, then the cat's out of the bag already, right? Any kind of lid space we lose definitely creates problems with Botox to make it feel very heavy. So I truly believe that a lot of people, depending on your genetics, some people need upper eyelids done in their late 30s or 40s or sometimes into their 50s, depending on how their skin is. But that really makes a big difference for people as far as not even just necessarily from an aesthetic standpoint for the brightness looking around the eyes. And then it makes your Botox less heavy, of course, because you don't have as much of extra lid space. But really in general, like it makes people feel like they can do big results with a very small procedure because it's done in the office under local. Downtime's like a few days. Sutures come out at day 5. Like it's amazing how fast it heals. It is amazing. But the results look incredible and not to a point where people are going to be like, oh, something's changed. It's more along the lines of like, did you sleep well last night? You can't quite figure it out, right? Exactly. And so the upper eyelids are huge for people in our age range, going through menopause, going through those, you know, because really, you know, in some of that's genetics, right? Some people genetically have lower eyelid bags. You can't fix that with filler, really. We used to try. It doesn't do a great job. And so those people need surgery to get that fixed. I mean, that's a little bit bigger surgery to do your lower eyelids versus uppers, but uppers can be done in the office in like half an hour, hour, super easy, very quick. You don't need general anesthesia for it. And though the results on that is a big deal.
And what are you basically doing when you do that upper?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, this line, natural line is called the lid crease where it's where you're, when you open your eyes, you can look at straight ahead and you can see some of that extra skin that wants to lay over top of it. Kind of this little stuff here. Right. And so taking a slip of that. And then also what I like to do, especially for my female patients, I don't do this for my male patients because it makes more of like a cat eye look, but it will pull. I do a little bit of a wing out here. So I pull the incision out a little bit and that pulls up. There's always this like little fold that happens at the end of the corner of the eye and you're trying to do makeup and it's just so annoying because you keep putting more makeup on and more makeup on. Next thing you know, your makeup looks like it's going down here. So getting rid of that little fold to bring that up really helps bring that corner of the eyelid up.
Yeah.
And in general, even with facelifts, we resuspend this lower part of the face can really help resuspend the lower eyelid in general. And because we lose the shape of the eye over time. Yeah. It becomes less almond shape, more oval shape, or more circular, where we get more show on the lower part of the eye. But even as we get older and the heaviness of the lids, you lose some of the clearance of the pupil. And so what that happens is a lot of that's from ptosis, could be from the muscle, but also extra skin plays into that too.
Yeah.
My patients oftentimes will tell me like, I cannot believe how much better I can see. Things are so much brighter. By the end of the day, they don't feel as heavy. Like you don't feel like you're like, ugh, you know, trying to lift your eyeballs up because it's just like, you know, the old like Looney Tunes where you're trying to like keep your eyes open. Yeah. And that can really make a big difference for people. For a small cost, it's, you know, as far as bang for buck, like that is a very powerful surgery. Additionally, the other things that can be really powerful is an upper lip lift. So basically reestablishing the distance from the base of the nose to the upper lip. As we get older, that elongates. Now, some people it elongates more than others. People who have more thinner upper lips tend to have more intern of their like a vermilion border or this like kind of red color in the lip. It will turn in more and then it looks very flat. So we get a blunted effect of this, of the upper lip. It becomes more smooth. We don't get as much of the definition of the column, but it also lengthens over time. And so bringing that back up into position can help with showing the teeth better, one, but also it can help prevent needing to overfill with fillers. Because if you honor someone's anatomy and their natural anatomy, if you put fillers in them, looks insane. You're just blowing up the lip when the reality is they might just need a little bit of a hike.
And then you're
doing something, again, this is in the office under local, like very small downtime, but that really makes a huge difference for patients. Those tiny little procedures can restore a lot of the especially kind of in the main areas where people can see, right? Because the nose, the lips, the eyes, those are the areas that people are always looking at and can converse with, right? And in the lip lesion, you know, if you have a cut in your lip and there's a 1 millimeter difference where they put the two edges together, the human eye can see that at a conversation distance.
That's so funny.
Huh? It's crazy. Wow. 1 millimeter, right? You're like, what? That's how powerful the midface is for our conversation and how we talk and interact with people.
Yeah.
And so that those two procedures in combination with, you know, fillers, Botox, and skincare stuff can make a really, really big difference and can really bridge people a lot over time till they're ready to maybe get a facelift or maybe not.
Till the facelift comes, Oh, that's so cool. What do you think about, like, because now we're in this, like, AI world that we live in and, you know, people are coming in with their AI filters and they want to look a certain way. Like, what? How do you even manage those expectations?
Yeah. And I think that that is true, right? And we're also in like the social media selfie world where everybody wants to look like a specific person or they have a vibe that they want, you know, and sometimes I'm very honest with my patients and I'm like, this is beautiful look, but it's not real. It's not real. And when it's not real, it's not necessarily going to be real for you. And have you thought about maybe this variation of that or that variation of it? The other thing is, too, is that we have software systems that will change your face for you to give you an idea of a result. And there's a lot of scrutiny with those softwares. I mean, obviously, we use them. It helps us have a visual representation. But it can set unrealistic expectations for patients because they're expecting what this AI-rendered version of them looks like. And maybe that's not how everybody feels different. Maybe that's not how it's going to end up looking at the end of the day. And that can really bother patients a lot. And I really tell people, I really encourage them to look at themselves and view themselves in a way like, okay, what is it that you love about yourself? Let's talk about that. What are the things that are your favorite features? And then, you know, we don't want to change that, right? And so if we don't want to change that, we don't want to go down this route of computerized, like what they think you should look like. And then we run into an era of how everybody starts to kind of morph to look the same, right? Similar lips, similar this, like they all look like cookie cutters of each other. And that, you know, that's not the focus of beauty. Like beauty is unique. Beauty is what is also a feeling, right? You don't have to be necessarily the most beautiful woman in the world, but maybe your personality is what makes you that, right?
Right. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I mean, do you get a lot of younger patients then, like teenagers and stuff that want like either Botox, fillers, or, you know, even...
Probably people in their 20s that are looking at baby Botox. And for some people, that's not a bad thing. And other people, I discourage them. And it really just depends on the patient, the patient's anatomy again, because some patients that have thinner skin, white people have very thin skin. And so they start to develop pretty significant wrinkles, crow's feet by the time they're in their late 20s sometimes. And so what do you do in those situations? You know, prevention Botox is what we like to call it. And honestly, like some people are about that and other people are not. I don't push it on people. I tell people though, like, look, if you have static wrinkles, meaning that you're not making that face, but yet you have those lines, that's usually the sign that it's a good time to start Botox. You don't want it to be really deep because I have a lot of like men who will come in and it's like really, really deep. I want to get this to go away. And I'm like, the cat's out of the bag on that one, buddy. Like, we're going to do our best to soften it, but really it's hard to get rid of the very, very deep wrinkles because that's at a deeper process of the skin that we need to get to. And you know, really, so I think that when I tell people that, they get frustrated about those things, but they also recognize that, okay, well, maybe this is something that I need to be okay with. This gives some character to me, but also at the same time, like, it's not making it completely go away, and that's okay too. So they learn to love those little things that they originally came in saying that they didn't like.
Do you get a lot more people because of, like, you know, people are, now we have such great treatments for, like, chronic conditions like obesity and inflammatory conditions. We know the GLPs help with inflammation, obesity, cardioprotective, all the things. But now you have people with all this extra skin and, you know, all of it. Are you getting more of that as well?
And, absolutely. I mean, for sure. Ozempic has really changed. They call them Ozempic face, Ozempic bodies. And it really has changed the game a lot because, and it's happening at younger ages too, right? Because people are losing massive amounts of weight and they have a lot of laxity in the skin and you can't really fix that. So my massive weight, I did a lot of massive weight loss patients. When I was in my training, I had a mentor that specialized in massive weight loss and did his fellowship at one of the only ones in the country. And so, you know, those patient population have been through some significant stress or significant body dysmorphia in their life. Mm-hmm. Now they're coming out with almost looks like a bodysuit that they have on and they don't like it. So some people will gain weight back because they don't like the way their face looks. And it's true in general that as the thinner we are when we're older, we look older than if we have a little bit of some fullness to our face. And so, you know, with the rise of that,
who are losing a lot of weight and like they start looking, especially unfortunately, like I think in the Caucasian population.
Yes, and that because it compromises the soft tissue integrity and those tissues just don't hold up as well. And the skin does not like to snap back like it used to. And also it depends how many times they've yo-yoed. It depends on their skin type. It depends on their whatever, right? But I do see a lot of that. And I think people are always a little bit disappointed that we don't have enough non-surgical skin tightening options out there. They're just not great. And I tell people, look, if they have 10 different devices for one thing, it's because they all suck. Yeah, in different ways. They don't work, right? Otherwise,
right? Like a plate, the pot, whatever,
Right, exactly. I mean, if there's 10 ways, there's all these different ways to do it. It's like buying eye cream. Like, there's a million of them because they're all terrible. Like, none of them work great. Like, let's be honest about that. And so I think that that really speaks to those things. And I think people finally come to the realization that they're going to need surgery. And so they end up doing facelift, neck lift. We do their breasts, their arms, their legs. I mean, I end up operating on these people year after year. They'll come in, get $60,000 worth of surgery every year. And then next year, it's another section of their body, another section of their face or whatever, until they're getting to the point where they're like, I'm happy now with all this extra skin resection. And some people need some of it some places and others don't. Yeah. It's really genetics like plays a big role into that too.
Yeah. It's so funny because, I mean, these surgeries are long, right? Like, I mean, I have another one of my BFFs in California as a plastic surgeon. She's like, oh, I just had a 12-hour surgery.
Yes. Yeah, body surgeries, especially when you're doing multiple things, because it can save people money by doing stuff all together. But they can be quite long and it can be really hard on the body too. And so, you know, obviously making sure the patient's safe for surgery and that they understand what they're getting into is super important as well.
But in terms of the aging thing, isn't this a common expression? I mean, I tell my patients too, like at some point you have to choose between your ass and your face. If you lose too much weight, your face is going to look, you know, whatever, older. If you keep a little ass, keep a little fat, you know, you might look younger.
That's true. Although we've gotten so much better with fat transfers and things like that, which we've been doing over many, many years. Actually, when I was doing research between my undergrad and my master's, I was doing research on fat injections for different various like veterinary ailments. And I didn't really appreciate that until now. And as much as I'm doing fat transfer, we did a lot of fat transfer to the breast and we're doing fat transfer to the buttocks. But really fat transfer to the face is the new thing now. It's really going to change the game. We're finding ways to make it more consistent. There's new products coming out that are going to be shelf stable fat transfer. So cadaveric fat that's been decellularized so that they can take those cells and use that without having to have a donor site to harvest from. And so really restoring a lot of that youthful contours with fat is really going to give you a very, very natural look.
That's so interesting because like a lot of people aren't getting implants anymore, right? They're getting fat
transfer. Right. And I do a lot of times I'll do breast lifts with fat transfer instead of breast augmentation. Or even with a breast augmentation, if it's a very thin patient, but they don't want the implant under the muscle, we can, you know, put a little bit of fat over top of it to make it have a smoother transition so that they're not getting that step off and we're not disrupting the muscle. And so some of these newer techniques that we have coming out, like placement of the implants in a subfascial plane just underneath the pec muscle fascia, but keeping the muscle intact, has been huge game changers for people, because now you're not really disrupting their own anatomy significantly, but you're still able to give them what they're looking for. And then you basically, what I like to tell patients is when we're doing fat transfer stuff, this is primarily like, you know, if you're looking at a painting and the painting has very defined edges, you're going to, your eye's going to go to that where the sharpness is. If you want a smooth transition, the body does that with fat, and I think that that's the best way to do it too. And it can be the face, it can be everywhere on the body, really. Hands, back of the hands too, because people don't like the back of their hands as they get older, right? And so fat transfer into the back of the hands can help restore some of that lost volume. But other things that we're recognizing about fat transfer is that how much it is actually significantly changing the skin as well. It's not even just volume replacement. It has so many good growth factors in it, has your natural exosomes, natural growth factors. And these things are really changing the texture and the tone of the skin as well. Like, it really does a beautiful job restoring that elastin and collagen and things like that that are naturally lost over time.
Oh, that's so interesting. Wow. I mean, Dolly, I can just ask you tons of questions, but I have to be cognizant of our time.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh my God, that's so good. But okay, I want to start this new thing that I want to do for part of my closing. So I like to call my listeners part of the Vagilante Nation. You know, because every podcast has, like, you know, their gang or
Of course. So I love that.
I'm a Vagilante as a gyno girl, so my listeners
love that.
Are the
I love that.
Nation. I'm coming up with this thing called a Vagilante verdict. So it's the one truth that Dr. Dahlia Rice wants every woman to hear loud and clear. Like, what's your verdict?
Do what makes you happy. Do what it is that you love. You know, don't let anybody else tell you that you should or should not do something. If something bothers you, fix it. If you're doing this all the time in the mirror, fix it. Yeah. You know, you only live one life. And you want to be able to enjoy your life the way you want to enjoy your life. And as much as we want to not really believe it to be true, you know, as we age, women can sometimes disappear in society. And that can, right, exactly. And that can be really hard. And especially in very public-facing careers or just in general with your interactions with people. Because people, we read each other's faces. And if you have this look of, like, anger on your face just because you have a lot of laxity, then that can make people feel pretty self-conscious about it or not want to take pictures or not want to do these things. I tell people, look, if you're not taking pictures, if you're changing your face in the picture to a certain way every single time, fix what it is you don't like. It's okay.
That's really good. Yeah. It's so interesting because I think, we do. Like, we don't allow ourselves to do some of these things that we should. And it's really, you know, you're right. We only live one life. And you know, why is everyone else to judge what we're doing if that makes you happy?
Absolutely.
And it's safe. We can get good results with someone like Dr. Dahlia Rice.
That's
thank
right.
you so much, Dahlia, for joining us today and pulling
thank
back the
you.
Curtain on the world of plastic surgery. If this episode gave you some new perspective, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Your body, your choice, your voice. That's the Vagilante way.
So yes.
I want to thank you again. You know, I'm here just to really help people learn and educate them so they can advocate for themselves. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to bring me on here. I always love chatting with you. We could talk all day long about all the things.
I know, I keep going. I have so many other questions.
I know. I'm like, okay, we need to do our own podcast again after this. Because honestly, so many interesting things coming out that really crisscross into our fields. Because, you know, I mean, like, your field and my field are like two hands that are holding. And who's taking care of this midlife population? Who? We are, you know, and that's important.
Absolutely. We are. And who's getting the shame for it? If we're talking about sex or for, you know, plastic surgery is like such a shameful thing to get, right? Like,
because again, like,
oh my God, we
dissolving that stigma, empowering people to do what it is that they love. Like, we don't need to live our lives by what other people are telling us we can and cannot do. You wouldn't have somebody tell you what kind of car you're going to buy or, you know, where you're going to go on vacation. And, you know, you know, that, I mean, obviously people feel stressed and guilty about those things as well. But, you know, even just normal everyday things, you know, like you're just going to do the things that are good for you. And that's one thing I love about our age range. Like when you hit your 40s, like your will to care about what other people think starts dissolving during perimenopause. Yeah. I'm like, ride that train because this is how it should be. You deserve these things. If that's what you want. Exactly.
I mean, that's why people pivot. Right. That's why people pivot. This article just came out in the USA Today about men on divorce. They actually interviewed me for it. But like, it's like, you know, I can say like people have very little time for bullshit.
Exactly, as they should, you know. And not only that, but like as women, we're told what to do, how to wear, what we should wear, how we should act, constantly minimized, constantly gaslighted. You know, at some point in time, you know, the woman has to decide for themselves what it is that they want, rather than someone telling them what
and
they
we already
want.
Have insurance in our exam rooms. We have like you know, politicians trying to dictate women's care, and so at some point it's like no. That's why, you know, both of us have kind of stepped outside of the insurance company, which we should talk about on a separate episode. I'm going to have you come back. Maybe we'll try it.
We could talk a lot about that for sure.
We should do it in person, like we said, because we both are in Chicago. I got to figure out the whole setup.
Yes.
I'll get you in person.
I would love that because especially the insurance stuff, we could go on and on about it. It's prevalent. It's the dark force in all of doctors' lives, and it's just making things impossible. That's obviously one of the reasons why I went into private practice, why you're going into concierge, because they're making it nearly impossible for us to take good care of our patients, which is really
sad. They're dictating the care that they have no business doing. So,
100%.
I think we should. We'll talk offline, or we should do a series. That would be so much fun. Okay.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Dr. Roman. I appreciate it again.
Too. And you guys should like and subscribe to my channel, and I'll see you next week.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.